and welcome to Caster Calls with Zombie Grub, episode 31. I am here with Frankie Ward, who many of you are going to recognize. If you're into CSGO at all, then she's been kind of a face of CSGO for a while at this point. You've done a ton of other events. You've been involved in a ton of other esports. You've done content for a bunch of different companies. I mean, I didn't write down your resume, but I think it's really exhaustive. So I'm really happy that you could make some time to talk to me. So big thank you. I just want to say that publicly and then ask how you're doing. How's your day?
Thank you. That was very nice. I'm very good. Thank you. I'm sort of on a off day from ESL Pro League, which I'm doing at the moment, which is Counter-Strike. But off days are doing other things that are not Counter-Strike. So it's busy but good, and every now and again then I go out to like this patio in this house that we've been renovating, and I like pull something out of it. It's really weird. I have a really weird life at the moment.
All right then, well, yeah, so this is I guess a great opportunity to learn about where you came from, because it kind of felt like, and I don't mean this in any like negative way, but it kind of felt like you appeared onto the esports scene with a flurry, and then suddenly we're just like everywhere. So I believe you have a background actually that's a little more on the technical side than a lot of the people who go into esports. So I'm just going to kind of ask you, like, what got you into esports? What got you to being an on-air talent?
So basically, I was in digital for a long time, like as a producer. I used to want to do radio. And then I was at uni in Birmingham. And then our radio station that we had at the uni had to go off air after a couple of weeks. So I just went around Birmingham, which is a kind of city. It's the second largest city in the UK, but it doesn't feel that big. But I just went around and interview bands with this dictaphone I couldn't technically get the audio out of because it didn't have a USB slot, but they didn't know that. So I used to just do that, and I'd write in things, and never got a proper like radio work experience at the BBC. I didn't live in London. I wasn't like well connected, but I did start writing and stuff, and then amassed a blog and wrote for other people. And then I sort of, that got me on my way. And then I did get into radio. It was a terrible experience. And went back into digital. Anyway, digressing. Moving forward, broadcasters, different places in the UK. And then I did a few different jobs at BBC. My last one was a senior producer, and it was for a product called BBC Live, which is basically live coverage of sports events. So they set it up for the Olympics. And then my job was to go out to other production teams around the BBC and just be like, hey, have you heard of this thing called BBC Live? And someone at BBC Sport pitched during League of Legends in 2015, because video games and the BBC, it's a complicated relationship because it's a public service broadcaster. So it's like PBS in the US. And so you can't be seen to be advertising one thing over another. You can't give something undue prominence, which is the technical term. But because League of Legends were doing a quarterfinals of their world championship at Wembley, it was like, oh, okay, well, the reason this is being given prominence is because it's a very significant event in the UK. And so therefore, there aren't other games doing this. So we should be allowed to do this one. And then that's kind of where I got brought in to go and build a website and run the online coverage side. I was mostly concentrating on the more on like the live blogging side of things with a lovely caster called Pulse, Richard Cam. And then you had James O'Leary, aka Stress, and you had Demon, Lee Smith, doing the actual kind of commentary for newcomers on the broadcast. So I wasn't actually directing the broadcast side. I was more kind of making sure that everything went online okay and everything was working. And Joe Miller was working on that production. I don't know if he was working for Riot directly at the time. I think he was, hence why he would be there, because Riot were very hands in. And so, yeah, I just really loved working with the production, and I really loved the audience I met, like someone I met on a tube train, and I put my little lanyard on and he saw that it was a League of Legends one, and he was like, do you work for Riot? And I was like, no, actually, I work for the BBC. And he was like, oh, I've heard that you guys are doing stuff, but I don't want to bother you. And I was like, nah, come with me. Let's have a walk and talk, because we've got to get from the tube to the stadium. So we had a nice little 10-minute chat and a stroll. And I just really like the people I met there. And I describe it as magic when I talk about it, because that's what it was to me. I hadn't been to many big sporting events previously. I danced in the Olympics. That was pretty cool because there were like 1,500 of us on stage dancing to a Dizzy Rascals Bonkers. That was wild. But actually, I think I was moved more in a way by the league experience, because I was there just kind of taking it all in. And the storylines about Faker, because he didn't play in the first match of their quarterfinal. So people were like, we know Faker's here, but is he going to play? And I was like, who the hell is Faker? Oh my God, he's the best player in the world and he's in London. So yeah, I got caught up in it. And after that went, well, BBC, I'm having to specialize in loads of different things. Like my last day at the BBC was train spotting live, like, which technically wasn't about trains. It was about locomotives. There is a difference, ladies and gentlemen. Train spotters, don't come at me, and I won't call you train spotters because I don't like that. But I would always love video games, and suddenly I had an opportunity to work in them through esports, through broadcast production. So when a job came up at Twitch, I applied for it. Well, 5 interviews, several months later, I went there as a producer. And then, sorry, I'm trying to fast forward for it. It's a long story. Oh God, I'm old. There's too much to tell. And then, sometimes I went on stage to cover for other people. And then, what's his face? The guy who cakes people, Steve Aoki, did a stage appearance at a stage I was producing at Gamescom, the expo in Germany. And we had to let him cake someone in the audience. And I was like cleaning up the cake and I got a cake stain on my ass. And I was doing an interview with this channel called Jinx TV. And then after, as a result of that interview, where I basically gabbled like this, they got me to be a co-host on their show called The Bridge, live every Thursday, went straight from the office to the studio, and that gave me live experience. So when I lost my job, along with like 40 other people on the same day at Twitch, I just wrote to some people like DreamHack and said, hello, can I be on your shows, please? and then I done some stuff at ESL UK as well, in the interim of joining Jinx and leaving Twitch as well. So yeah, I had some stuff and people hired me.
Yeah, that's quite a story. It is one of the more unique ones for esports, because you did have more of a technical background than a lot of other people. A lot of other esports, you know, very much so are nerds at home who love talking about games, who just get increasingly more popular until they learn how to be entertainers and broadcasters. But you kind of came in from more of a technical background, and then also got merged with video games. So I feel like you're one of the people who are leading the charge, I guess, in that kind of sense, where I use you as an example of someone who came from a little more of a technical background. And that probably is going to happen more in the future of esports. You know, everyone's into video games, so you don't need to just have like an overwhelming passion to get really high up in this world of esports, especially because it's becoming so much more, you know, professional and professionally minded, I suppose. And you have all the industry terms that you've already used, some now being used and whatnot. So I think it's a really awesome background to kind of delve into. So you wanted to fast forward, and I'm going to slow down and actually ask you more stuff about it. So did you go to school for anything like journalism or broadcasting, anything particular?
No. Okay. So always when I tell people my degree, they're like, of course you did that. I actually studied drama and theatre arts at the University of Birmingham. So it was a degree. It wasn't a conservatoire. I wasn't studying to become an actor. I was really studying something that I was passionate about and felt like I could do for 3 years. There was some performance involved, but to be honest, especially in the last year, because I was technically employed by a radio station before I graduated and I had to move. So I did more written things than performance things. And also because it's impossible to write a good performance essay where you're just like, I applied Stanard Lasky's techniques in the way that I marked up my script. I was very conscious of the intention behind this movement when I walked towards the door. Like, no one teaches you how to write those essays, whether you're doing them at A level, which is a high school qualification in the UK, to actually doing a degree in them. No one teaches you how to do those essays. So I actually sometimes picked a module because I knew how to write for that lecturer, like, which I know sounds insane, but I'm a bit funny about further education. Like, I'm so glad I went to Birmingham because it gave me a career, because I did things outside of my degree, and I was very motivated to do so. I couldn't do that back where I grew up, but also I think that it's not necessarily essential either. So that was my degree. But when I went to uni, just before I went, the Wii had come out and I went to my savings, took out money for my Wii. Obviously took my PS2 with me. I didn't have a gaming PC at the time. I had a PC that could run Morrowind 2 on it and Sims. I didn't have like a souped up thing. But it was enough to play sort of some stuff.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's still that whole idea of you being able to work with what you wanted and having that drive is obviously very important in esports, where there's that not as rigid approach to getting a job in esports or learning in esports. So that obviously worked out well for you. Yeah. And then you worked through radio, and you worked a bit more on the production side of things and kind of oversaw what other people were doing. I would guess, right? You had the big room with all the knobs and switches and all the monitors, and you saw what other people were doing as on-air talent. Did you ever look at that and go like, I could do that better, or I'm going to do that one day, or anything like that?
So technically I was presenting for the station I worked for before I was producing for them. So I did a pre-recorded show from my bedroom at uni in my third year. I basically recorded the link. So it's something called voice tracking. So you have live radio, and then you have shows you almost record as live. So in a program like Myriad, for example, you have these things called carts. So you have a set number of carts depending on your memory bank. Some of those carts you use to put songs into. Some of them you might record links into. Some of them you might put your stings or your audio beds. To a radio program like Myriad, it's all the same thing. It's all audio files. So you set them up. You press spacebar to maybe start the end of a track, so you can set where you want the track to come in, either on that moment or when you upload the music to the track, you know when the voice, you manually add when the voice ends and when the voice starts, kind of thing, so you can go up to the vocal if you're recording, right, or if you're live. So I would voice track, or I do links and they would be put into the show and then manually kind of voice track to hit the vocals. That makes sense. And then when I went to Newcastle, which is in the north of the country, I worked at the same place. It's called Amazing Radio. Sorry. I've got terrible radio voice. We specialized in new music, new artists. And I had my show taken away. And I was producing the afternoon show, which was the flagship show. But then the producer of that show kind of turned around in the meeting and went, why are we taking all these voice reels in, like, of people trying to be Frankie when we have Frankie? So I got my show back. But it was just a weird place to work. Like, I was told I was going to be presenting the chart show by this guy who was our managing director, who came to the office every now and again. He'd been big in mainstream radio in the 90s. And I went away to this festival called Glastonbury. And then I came back and I just sort of was in a meeting and I went, I'm not doing the chart show anymore, am I? And someone went, yeah, no, sorry. And they'd taken me off it, even though I'd never got to record an episode. I just had a meeting with the managing director where we'd sat in a room and I think he was challenging me on something, but he wasn't being very direct in what he wanted me to do. So he decided there and then I wasn't capable of doing the show, which was very weird because I didn't know I was being tested for the show. It wasn't like a, let's actually have a rehearsal at this. It was kind of, it was a bit more opaque. And I was 21. I didn't really know what was happening. But I was mostly a producer there. So I did bits and pieces, but it was a horrible place to work. Like, it was the worst place I've ever worked. I've had some shit experiences, but that was like the worst. So I left after 9 months, not actually of my own choice. I would have left. I was looking for places to go, but mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's very unfortunate. That's sounds like a crappy work environment.
It was, but it taught me a lot about making sure something isn't a crappy work environment, which is the key thing.
Yeah. And I suppose it taught you a little bit about the quote unquote politics of, I guess, working with the industry.
Yeah.
Which, you know, may or may not be useful, I guess, in esports, because there is still, you know, a divide between like radio broadcasting, on-air, like television broadcasting and esports broadcasting. But they are merging closer every day. So that's, I guess it's an important experience that everyone has to learn. Hopefully not so brutally, though, is kind of the hope.
I think for me, because I like, oh God, someone once said to me, I don't do content management systems. I'm a creative. And I've never forgotten how much of a twat it made them sound. I do both. So I create things for a platform. So the key things when I'm producing is, who is my audience? What have I got to work with? And ultimately, yeah, what is the goal here? What is the platform? So in radio, if I'm producing the mainstream show that I was doing, I've got 4 hours. I have this presenter. We've got new music. Our listeners are really interested in obviously discovering artists, and our artists upload their music because they want to be discovered. So it was always kind of creating features around that, like Matchmaker, where someone from the audience sent me 3 artists that they liked listening to who were very known artists potentially. So I researched them, and then I would find them 3 songs to listen to from our database. And then we'd do an interview after they'd had some time with those songs and go, and I would say, so which one is your Matchmaker pick? Or I get the presenter to do that. But I would explain, as producer Frankie on the air, would explain why I'd chosen those songs for them. So it was kind of, that's how I design features, whether it's for online, whether it's for like online as a written article, whether it's for radio, whether it's for a video, or whether now in my job, even though I'm not a producer, I am on-air talent. My job is still to think about what the audience wants, and I'm also thinking about what the producer wants. If I'm interviewing, I'm thinking about what the desk needs for their storylines. So there's always a kind of thinking about, like, what is this for? Like, what is the end goal here?
Yeah, and that's really important. Usually something we get into a little bit later, but the goals of what you, whatever you do, right? So you host, you interview, you sideline reporting, but even commentators, right, are all thinking kind of along those lines. But you, more so than even the commentators, even the play-by-play commentator, are that entry into whatever show is mm-hmm. happening, whatever esports happening, whatever show is happening. So you in particular have to really focus on those subjects. Now, did all of this experience from your radio broadcasting, your production, did it all kind of come to a point and make you immediately a really good host? Did you get good feedback there, or was this actually something where you had to change from being more of the, I don't know how to say, like, you know, you had more time to think, to suddenly being on air, just kind of talking and ad-libbing as well, right? Like, there was very few rehearsed esports shows, and there's not a script for esports shows, right? So I'm asking, did you come in good to esports, or did you have to have a very painful learning process?
I know it sounds really bad, but I think I came in good mm-hmm. because I worked very quickly. But the reason, it doesn't mean I was instantly always good. Mm-hmm. It was more that I picked up things along the way. So I did a work placement with the BBC when I was 19, and we had interview training as part of that, you know, learning about open closed questions, active listening, learning actually that, because some people are like, when they're sharing their pearls of wisdom about interviewing, and obviously relevant, but they'll always say only ask open questions. I'm not about that, actually. I think closed questions can be so great sometimes. Like, we, like at Katowice, the CSGO major in 2019, we had this team, Navi, and the storyline was that they hadn't even boot camp, like they practiced for a few days. So I asked the player, do you actually want to stay together and win this major? And he went, we'll try our best. And I went, but that's not yes or no. Do you want to, like, what do you want? Like, is this a yes or no situation? Because I can't see that you want this, like, and I got called a bitch for that, but I don't care, because for me I was closing an interview in a different way, and I'll still do it sometimes, but obviously not in exactly the same way. But yeah, so I did have some interview training at BBC way back, and I put myself on camera. I used to go around and interview comedians when I worked in comedy at the BBC for a bit, and I would do interactive touch screen like videos where there were 5-minute interviews, and then the comedian would mention maybe a video or something like that on this platform called Touchcast, and I would bring the visual elements up on screen so people could touch them to kind of leave the video briefly and engage with that element. So I was always kind of experimenting with platform, and I was putting myself on camera, but at the BBC, like, no one was interested in me actually doing that as a job, because it's a big place and I'm not famous, and definitely was not known back then either. I knew loads of people from internally, and because I went between different departments, and I always liked to kind of find out how things work. And like my watch, what shall I search for? I'm always searching for things. Yeah, I like meeting people and just finding out different things. And like, yeah, so, oh my God. I'm being upstaged by my own watch, so it's fine. I once got upstaged by a beach ball at a Call of Duty event, so it's fine. I'm taking it off. Yeah, so what I was trying to say is I put myself on camera, but I never get someone else to put me on camera. And then when I went to Twitch, sometimes I had to put myself on stage because I had enough money to pay for like two hosts for a 12-hour show. And at some point, they might have knowledge gaps because they're covering 30 games in a day. And also they need to actually have a break at some point. So sometimes I would go on stage. And I was kind of conscious about that because there was someone who I used to work with really, really didn't like me being on stage at all. But I moved departments and I had DJ Week from Twitch, who everyone knows, like, managing me. And he was just so lovely and understood. Like we hired a production team, I should say, to do that. Most of my work was pre-production, and then at the actual events it was very much more about shaking hands. That sounds so disingenuous, I don't mean it like that, but it was much more about making sure people were at ease on stage, that they knew what they were going to do once they're on stage, and that they were going to enjoy themselves. And that's kind of what I do sometimes when I'm on a desk and I'm doing interviews. I'm making sure my analysts are happy with what they want to talk about. If I'm desk hosting, if I'm stage hosting, I go out and I see their audience before the show goes live. I will go and chat to as many people as I can, get them feeling warmed up if I can't do a on PA warm up. And if I'm interviewing, I'm hanging out with the interviewees when I can, like before we do interviews, and just seeing how they feel, because it gives me an idea of how I can take that interview. If their first language isn't English and they're a bit nervous, I can kind of brief them a bit on what I want to ask. I normally avoid that if I can, but I also want them to be comfortable enough to talk to me. So there's stuff that I learned as a producer that I apply very much to what I do now.
It sounds like it. That's really good advice. All of what you just said, like going into the crowd, never thought about that. But it really does imbue with a sense of energy. I haven't done any stage hosting, but I've been on a stage doing commentary. And the feeling of it is just so amazing. And when you get to talk to the people that are just like right in front of you, we had a game in Paris that was just the French crowd can be super amazing.
Yeah.
And that I almost wish that I had gone up and talked to all these people in the front row, because they would try and talk to us, but we were like, you know, headset on, rehearsals being done, stuff like that. So that's very good advice. So you said that you were kind of actually trained by the BBC earlier. That sounds very cool. Can you give us like a brief breakdown of like what that training entailed? And don't be afraid to go into specifics, because that's kind of what this podcast is about. You already kind of did, you know, maybe unintentionally, you said open and close questions. And I think we kind of, you know what that means. But yeah, what was the lingo that you learned? What was the big points that they taught you?
So it was an hour interview training, although we then did basically the same interview training actually with my department years later when I was actually being paid by the BBC, which is quite fun. It's kind of nostalgic. So the main things, as I mentioned, obviously knowing what an open question is. So that's a question that lets them kind of, it's not a yes no question, it's not a binary answer question essentially. So how are you is an open question. Are you okay is a closed question. And sometimes you can sort of see people aren't getting much from someone because they're only asking closed questions. So it takes someone who's very sure of themselves and is an experienced interviewee in a way to say more, or they feel like they want to give more. So they'll give you more than just a yes, no answer. And an open question obviously lets your interviewee go off somewhere. And then if you're actively listening, if you're listening to points to follow and to respond to, you can then ask more about it. Now, you don't always want to ask more about it, because maybe there's not that much there, and maybe you've been tasked with finding out something for the desk if you're sideline interviewing. But for me, I definitely like to actively listen, and most of my interviews will actually have quite short follow-up questions because of the fact that I am saying like, oh, tell me more about that thing. Like that was one of the key parts of the interview training, is just tell me more about that thing, because it works. Again, harder when you've only got 2 minutes on the sideline, so you have to kind of pick and choose your moments. I'm trying to think other stuff. Obviously, body language. I think we went through body language a little bit. It's also where I discovered my technique of charming and disarming, which is where we were doing practicing, and I got my interviewee feeling very comfortable, and then then maybe it went for a Cobra Kai and hit him with a harder question. I don't get the opportunity to really do that much, because again, I don't get to do interviews that are longer than a few minutes usually, but it's really great when I do have the opportunity. And I'm trying to think what else. Or we saw people do interviews, so we heard the radio audio of two, I think it was on Five Live, which was a sports and talk radio network in the UK, and they had this boy on the line, and they were just asking him closed questions, and he was like no yes. And then after the interview, this is a 7-year-old kid who'd spoken on the radio, and they were really rude about it, and they were just like, oh, well, he doesn't tell us much. But it wasn't his fault, it was them. And that's always stuck with me, as has the example of a killer closed question. So there is a famous interviewer, political interviewer in the UK called Jeremy Paxman, who was doing an interview with someone from, I believe it was Alderhay Hospital, where you had children dying during open heart surgery on the table. And he had the head of surgery with him in an interview. And he said something along the lines of, Mr. Surgeon, would you let him operate on you? And the surgeon said no. And that was like, whoa. I'm easily entertained, clearly. But that's, for me, that's such a brilliant moment, because in that no, it tells you everything you need to know, which is that guy should not be editing. Not only should that guy not be operating on kids, let alone anyone, but his own boss doesn't believe him either. Like, doesn't believe he should be operating on kids. Like, that's a huge admission of guilt in a way, because the person who's being interviewed is responsible for that person. So the kind of implications of that is a big thing. And it led to, when I'm on the sideline, when players give me a kind of answer which is just like a win's a win or something along those lines, well, I can go, a win's a win this time, but if you play like that against the likes of these bigger teams, you're not going to win. So what are you going to do about it? And I think I've got a reputation for being nice, and hopefully I am nice, and I feel that the players respect me because I respect them too. But if someone doesn't give me an honest answer, then I'm going to pick them up on it. Like, I'm not going to like moan at them and say, or moan afterwards and be like, well, they didn't tell me the truth, or they were rubbish or something like that, because it's on me to get the answer from them. So I don't think it's fair to blame the player, but I will do my hardest in that interview to kind of get something, or I'll change tack if I need to. But yeah, the 2 minutes or the 90 seconds sometimes thing is always on my mind, like, what have I got to work with, you know?
Right, yeah. It's the charm and disarm is the phrase you used. It sounds like it works. Yeah, because I mean, I think generally you're seen as a very like nice, you know, bubbly person, but it is kind of deceiving because you have asked these really, really tough questions. So I think it's what like people like. I mean, there's also a little bit of that just as humans, like contradictions kind of intrigue us. So like you as kind of a contradiction when you do that is just immediately you go from like being like, oh, there's, I mean, you might even be seen as airheaded by some people initially, right? Like very happy, very pretty, all done up, whatever. And you're like, okay, how'd you do? And they say, I did well. And you say, okay, tell me about your game. They tell you about the game. And then suddenly you're like, bam, with the hard question. I think that picks people's ears up, right? That like that makes them perk up. And they're like, whoa, like, shit, that came from nowhere. Or that came from, not the heart, but it came from a place of understanding, of, you know, shoot, I can't think of the words. You obviously understand the game, which is why you can ask the question. You know the player and you respect the player and they respect you, so you can ask the question. Suddenly, I feel like it just elevates you because it is so easy. The reason I'm doing this is because it is so easy to be a host or an interviewer, someone who's supposed to be kind of bubbly and excited and happy because you want to draw people in, and just do that and just be that person. I think that's the easiest way to initially kind of get some credit, is to make sure that everyone having a good time, right? but it can sometimes lead to really, you know, meh interviews. Like there, you can see a lot of interviewers who don't have anything in particular that makes them stand out. They ask the same questions. If someone says a game's a game, a win's a win, or whatever it is, and the person goes, yeah, you're right about that. And then they go on. I think that's a very common thing you see. And it's a common thing that I've done as well, where it's like, I don't know how to make you answer a harder question. So I'm just going to kind of go, okay, yeah, I see your point, you know, and you just leave it there. And it's not exactly a very interesting interview. And I think that's why you've become quite popular as an interviewer. You're actually a standout interviewer, where a lot of other people, you know, more so their credit is based off of their showmanship or whatnot, which you have, of course. I don't mean to say that you only get by on interesting questions, but I think that's why people like you. And that's certainly what I've listened to. I kind of went the whole like, oh, okay, she seems really nice, you know, three, four years ago when I first saw you. She seems kind of nice, you know, that's great. Oh, shit. Like, oh, okay, that was interesting. Oh, that was good. Oh, okay, shit. Like, I think you did a very good job of that, which is clearly from, you know, years of experience, which you had before entering the esports world. So I also think you're right that you came in kind of good and you just got better. Did you come into the esports world, you know, you moved kind of like a little bit gradually into it from the production, from a couple of TV shows or online shows. But when you started to really get into the esports side of things, did you see these mistakes, these pitfalls from a lot of people? And you were like, oh, okay, they haven't gotten the years of experience that I have. And I think that they could learn better, or I could improve on that. Or was there actually already a pretty good baseline talent in esports by the time that you got in?
I went full-time as a host in, thank you, by the way. I went full-time as a host in May 2018. So yeah, my first job as a full-time host was NHL, hosting a desk there in Stockholm for a sort of a qualifier thing. And I'd never hosted a desk before, so that was terrifying, especially about a game that I'd never played. I do watch other people, and I did watch other people. And so it wasn't necessarily about me being better or not making mistakes that I felt like they were making. It was just about being different and being myself. Like, and knowing, I think that's the key thing. It's knowing who you are. And when I was at the BBC, there was like a careers week, and there was a thing about being on camera. So I booked in for that. And at the end of the session, this lady said, you could do this, but what do you want to actually do? Like, what do you want to talk about? And I didn't know, because I was always like, well, I've interviewed comedians, but there are other people who can do that better than me, and I've done music radio, but I'm not as in the loop in new music as I used to be, because I've been busy with other things. So I guess there are other people who can do that better than me. I didn't know. And then I think when I was watching Rocket League, when I already worked for Twitch, went over for the season 2 in Amsterdam, a few of us from the UK office flew over to help out. And I was watching that event, and then I went, I could do this. And I was like, oh my God, I know what I want to talk about, finally. So I didn't go into Twitch going, I want to host esports. It was just more like, more kind of seeing stuff and just going, yeah, I could do this. And that was at the end of 2016, when I kind of had that realization. It took me a while to actually do it. Because I was always like, my first job here is a producer. Like, I can't be putting stuff aside to like not do that job. But yeah, so I think when I came in, I kind of surveyed what other talent there were. And you've got amazing, incredible talent in esports. I think it was just more about going, where do I fit in? And is there anyone like me? And I didn't see anyone like me, to be honest. So I was pretty confident that, because I knew my voice, and I mean, I was 29 when I went full-time as a host, I had the confidence to kind of go and be it. I think the difficult part is, once you've broken in, like, kind of staying true to that, because there are a lot of people who want to change you, and there are a lot of people having comments and opinions on you and whether you even belong and like how you should be doing your job and things. So to try and like stick to that is really hard. I have to say that's one of the hardest things to do. But you watch VODs, you watch back what you've done, you get better. And that's a key thing. VOD reviews are so, so important. Like, it helps a lot to watch yourself and hate yourself.
Yeah, it's never fun. What specifically are you looking for when you do those FOD reviews? Do you have a list of things you're pinpointing?
So habits. I mean, I say so a lot. There's part of me that can't eliminate that entirely, although it would be really useful if I get to do a 3-minute interview and 2 minutes of that is going to go on air. I do need to sometimes be conscious about how they're going to cut that interview together if they drop out the middle question. So sometimes after I've recorded an interview, I'll be like, I know that the way I said that was as a pickup, whereas actually I need to do it as a standalone. So let's just re-record this question. So on EPR right now, there's occasional moments where we'll do once or twice, I've re-recorded a question to make it work for the editor, or I've re-recorded the intro outro. Looking at repetition, I say basically a lot. I slip in and out of it. There's some days I'm better than others. I don't tend to say much when I'm on broadcast. I think it was from maybe Anna Prosser that I learned that. I actually breathe through it instead. It does mean I had to take a pause rather than saying and kind of stumbling. I find my way. I've never lost my way, if that makes sense. I'm just kind of on a process, because I don't want to like just always go on air and be like, right, I'm going to say this, 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 and this. I will do thinking on air. It doesn't look like it. It just looks like I'm speaking really slowly and I've lost my marbles. But I do it when I'm in casual conversation. I say like far too much and I say but I'm kind of easy on myself because I'm not on camera, so whatever. So that, and sometimes just the questions. When I was doing the Katowice major, I was so determined to prove I've done my research, I know what I'm talking about, but I didn't have the confidence entirely yet. So sometimes I second guessed myself, even though I knew the thing. And I had Carmack, who's like head of all esports of ESL. I don't actually know his grand vizier of esports at ESL. Fantastic person. He said to me, he took me to one side, like one or two days in out of the green room, and then was just like, Frankie, I want to speak to you about something. I want this to be more dynamic. I want the microphone to be quicker between you. Like, I want you to just be quick with your question and get in. Dudum. He literally went, dudum. And it changed so much for me, because this was only my second event as an interviewer. I came in as a desk host, did stage hosting and stuff. Like, that was my domain. I always thought I was going to do the stage thing. And he just changed everything for me, because I went back to the hotel and I watched and I was like, oh, God. I was so like, Jesus Christ, why am I setting up everything? I've got so little time and the audience already knows all this stuff and the desk has already established this stuff. I don't need to talk about this, 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 and this. I just need to ask them about the game. So that's how it went. The exit interviews at Katowice, my first one, I was way too protective of the player. I'm happy with the way I do exit interviews. Like, I can probably be a bit braver in terms of pushing the player, but I really judge it on how that player is. If I know that player potentially has more visible emotions than other players, and I have to judge how comfortable they are with that. I'm not going into an interview to make someone cry, as much as people probably want that. I don't want that. I want them to feel good about the interview after they've left it. I don't want them to feel worse, because that's awful. Like, I know that if when someone's in a vulnerable moment, like one thing said could tip them over, and that's awful. And I think that's much more something to be more aware of maybe when you're at an arena, whereas if you're doing an online event, it's potentially not as hard. But it's something I'd still like feel like I'm learning at. But yeah, those are the kind of things I look for if I'm stage hosting and desk hosting. Like, we always have to stand, right? It's moving. I prefer hosting sitting down. I'm so much more centered. I'm much more balanced. I'm much more confident. When I'm standing, I'm the shortest person on the desk. I'm normally having to wear heels to try and bolster me up a bit if they don't have an Apple box. And I have a habit, sometimes I sway. First time I did it, I was really bad. I've got better, still not 100%. So yeah, I really do look at those things.
Yeah, all very good notes. There's a couple things in there I want to touch on, but first of all, I think the emotion thing is kind of a funny, just StarCraft having been very much so Korean dominated for a very long time, changing now, but you know, in their culture, they are very reserved. And so there's been the, you know, faceless Korean was a common term back in the day. Anyways, there's been a couple of people in the community that literally have been like chanting to like make sure they get the shots of like players crying and whatnot. And one guy won Katowice 3 years ago, and Sarah? He had been Sue.
Okay, cool. So I'm confused with when Cyril won. Was that the following year?
Yeah, Cyril won BlizzCon. So there he's never go. Actually sorry. Won a Katowice, yeah.
Yes. No, I remember the photos from Katowice. Sorry, I just couldn't remember the player. Sorry. Tell me the story.
So Sue is like a guy who's gotten like literally like seven run like second places, like and a lot of them in the row. Like he actually technically won one championship, but no one cared. It wasn't very prestigious. So this guy's like, he's gonna retire soon. It's his last chance. And he wins and he's crying and, you know, Smix is on stage talking to him and is also kind of getting a little tearful. And just these people that I don't want to name names. I don't think they'd mind, but still they're just like chanting like on Twitter. They're chanting like in Twitch chat. They're like, zoom on the face, zoom on the face, zoom on the face. Because, you know, Sue's actually crying. He's so overwhelmed that he won finally such a big event on first place, too. He thought he was going to let it all go again and get second. And I just remember, like, I was like, you know, this is like this great story, you know, great emotions. This is going to be in the highlight reel for eons. But also, like, man, I'd hate to be that player up on stage having my emotion just like pushed, you know, like cameras just right on him. And Sue's very, what's the word? Very in touch with that as well. She doesn't want the player to be crying and emotional, but. But still, yeah. If someone else is crying and Sue's like very empathetic, that's the word I'm going for. She's very empathetic. I feel like there's a bit of like a feedback loop that goes on with her. Anyways, getting the emotions is like, it's something that I think a lot of esports struggle with. And then as, you know, people are like, yeah, you should get the emotion. You should get the really like juicy stuff out. It's a delicate balance, right? To actually push and pull away. And I think it does have to be, you know, you have to be empathetic. As an interviewer, which is something that is very difficult to train. I have no idea how you'd even start. And then I think you have to know the players, which you've done a fabulous job on from what I can see, from what I can hear. But you, you know, kind of came in a little bit late. So, you know, what I also want to touch on is that, like, you gave us the year, right? 2017?
So 2018 was 2018, yeah. So January 2018 was the first event where I was stage hosting, and I was actually like paid to stage host. That was my first event, and I was still working for Twitch. So I did a couple of events. I did on stage for Insomnia, where like I had to run back from the loo because I didn't realize how fast Overwatch. It was only I think maybe it was only a best of one or something in the final. Like I didn't tournament organize. I like ran the stage and stuff, and like. Me and Nysera, lovely Nysera, who is probably known for Heroes of the Storm, she does a lot of car content now. We were hosting that stage together and had to run back from the bathroom. And I was like out of breath on stage and I'm like running around the stage. That was 2017. But yeah, like 2018, I'd say is like when I first really kind of started.
So, but that's amazing then, because that's, I mean, I actually don't know the exact history of CSGO, to be honest, but CSGO was becoming more popular. I guess they kind of fixed the game at one point after 2012. By 2015, I feel like that's where it was really hitting its stride. And you didn't come in then. You came in 3 years after that. So that puts you, it feels like, so far behind. I mean, did you go into that feeling you're so far behind? How did you study this game so that you not only knew what to say? I mean, the confidence isn't going to be there for, as you were saying, until you do a lot of these events, but you still had the knowledge. You still had the ability to push and pull because, you know, in 2019, even a year, I guess, after you'd done these events, it's still amazing to me that you would be able to judge rather accurately how to talk with these players. Did you make it a point to go and talk to the teams every day or the players every day? Like what was your training regimen, I suppose?
So my first CS event was this thing called the Gundam Premier where I was desk hosting, and it was tier three teams, winner takes all, 50 grand prize pool. And that was like, you could really research because most of the teams didn't even have a Liquipedia page and they were mixed teams who put themselves together for the event. For the most part. And then I did the Face It London America's Minor. And I was called in to do that like less than 5 days before. And so I look back on my notes now and I'm like, oh my God, how did I do it? Like, I'm so skeletal. So yeah, I just found out what I could. And I really talked to the analysts. The analysts are always super helpful. We have incredible analysts in esports in general. But I was really lucky. I was working with Pimp, Maniac and also who was the other analyst on that event? Oh my god, that's really bad. Halvor. Oh my god, Halvor, who's now the coach for Dignitas, a Swedish lineup that they have in their men's Counter-Strike division. And they were all so lovely, and you know, it was kind of constructing the desk segments with them and all that kind of stuff. So I learned a lot. I met some of the players there. Like I got on straight away with a player called Cadian, who's now in-game leader for a team called Heroic, who, and they're doing fantastically well. And I kind of, that was a really nice way to start kind of building up relationships with players, like these working relationships. But then I didn't do another Counter-Strike event until nearly the end of the year. I think it was October, doing something called Star Series. And that was my first interviews role in any esport. But yeah, again, I just kind of looked at Liquipedia. I use HLTV a lot because there's stats from games. So I can't watch everything. So I can look at the data of a game and kind of work out what happened. There's so much to help you. So yeah, it was, to be honest, it was mostly research and then being there. And when I'm doing an event, I'm listening really closely to the cast, partly because I need to pick up on the storylines that they're talking about and carry those through, and obviously the desk segments as well. So it was learning on the job and then trying to play CS when I could. But I was traveling so much in 2019. I was away from home for about 7 months of the year. So it was like, how does one actually, yeah, do it? So yeah, I was doing a mobile event like the week before I did Katowice. I was prepping information on 24 teams from a little travelodge in Dortmund, Germany, going, I don't know how I could do this. But then once you're there and the event's going on, obviously people are talking about the teams and you're seeing them perform and all that kind of stuff. So I've done a lot of games. I think I might have hosted more games probably than anyone on the scene at the moment. I'm not sure. That's an outlandish claim, and I'm probably a fool for saying it. But at the end of the day, all players care most about winning, and it's kind of like what they've done to get there, what they're doing at the event, and the significance of what it would be to win. There's certain themes that unite all esports, mm-hmm. as well as obviously in-game things. Like trading is a concept you will see obviously from card games like Hearthstone to Counter-Strike, when you're trading players and you're taking risks and things like that. There's things that connect everything. And once you get that in your brain, then you kind of understand what you're looking at when you look at any game or any esport.
It's still so daunting to me as someone who's, you know, finally trying to step outside of just StarCraft 2 and do any other esports. Now I'm having nightmares of, you know, not knowing what to say on a desk in a game that I haven't done. So it still sounds so daunting. Obviously, you talked about having, you know, a lot of study sessions, like reading a lot of the statistics, and certainly that can help. But I think actually picking up on the commentators, talking with the analysts, all that stuff is actually something that's I would say is usually a skill that you build up to know, you know, when the commentator is saying something important, when they're building up a story that's actually something that you can kind of pull at. I would say that's a skill, but it seems like you adapted rather quickly. And you did, as you said, you've done so many games. So you came in very, you know, pretty late into esports relatively, and then you really exploded. You're doing all these things. You're nonstop traveling in 2019, apparently, studying all the games as well. Is there anything specific that you really point to with how much you were able to just like jump in to the deep end almost, compared to other people who, you know, they've done years of an esport, they've done years of building themselves, now they're trying to do variety, or they've always done variety, but they can't really seem to get as many jobs as you have. Like, is there anything you point to? Is it having an agency? Is it having that technical background? Do the producers love working with you and their word of mouth kind of travels? Like, can you give us any hints?
I don't know. I think so. It's very hard sometimes to kind of frame myself in this way, because like I'm sponsored by Intel UK, who are awesome. And actually the manager who looks after me in the rest of the Intel squad the other day said, Frankie, you should get a logo. Have you thought about getting a logo? And I was like, no, why? And he was like, well, you're an influencer. You should have a logo. And I was like, well, I don't kind of see myself as that. But if I look at it, I do have an audience. So I kind of like shrivel up inside. I have an audience, especially like on Instagram, for example. And I can look at my Instagram. I can see lots of people follow me from India because I did a PUBG mobile event once. And there was an Indian team there and an influencer called Mortal, who was there, gotten very well with. Then in Brazil as well, there's a lot of Brazilian Counter-Strike players. So you can kind of, like, I don't know if I would say influence, but I have an existing audience who kind of might be interested in other games that I'm doing. They might check them out because they heard I was doing the event. They won't necessarily watch specifically for me because I'm not going to be on screen all the time, but they might. It might spark the curiosity about it. So I think I have some value in that sense. Like when me and Machine did the LEC a couple of weeks after the major, we did like a Counter-Strike crossover episode where Machine was desk hosting and I was doing interviews. And that was interesting for the audience because it was this concept of these people coming in from this completely different esport. Just for the week. And I think it went down really, really well with the viewers. So sometimes I think I get asked to do other games because I kind of bring the value of another game with me, which is really cool and very happy to do that. Sometimes it's because I've worked with someone in the past, like Overwatch World Cup in 2018, I worked with Blizzard. And when Zoe unfortunately had a family emergency and had to go back to Switzerland and didn't know if she was going to be able to broadcast from there, I came in to host the desk for 1 or 2 weeks because I knew all the talent. Love them. They're so great. Knew the talent, some of the production team who was like the ones who were still there. And I knew the game. I had to catch up with some certain things, but I used to play that game all the time in the Twitch office. Had our own Twitch team called Overlunch. And so even a t-shirt. And yeah, so I had that kind of background so I could jump into it. And then mobile games, I think because there isn't necessarily an established host for a mobile game because they don't tend to have stage events multiple times during the year, it means that I can maybe come in because I've done mobile games for a couple of years now. I can come in and they know I'm going to do a good job. I'm reliable. And then it's kind of bye for another year, I guess. So I think there's different things. And like when I started out, I wanted to be European Golden Boy. That was like my thing, because I think Golden Boy is just insanely talented, right? I can't commentate like Golden Boy can. He can do everything. It's insane. He can do any game. He can do any role. And he's amazing. And he's also just the most brilliant colleague you could have as a fellow talent. He is just so lovely, brings people in the crew and the talent together. I can't say enough nice things about Alex. I just think he's like, I aspired to be him when I started out doing this job, and I still aspire to be him in the way that he does his job on screen and off screen as well. I'm digressing. I'm sorry. So I think, yeah, it was partly, yeah, there's the value I add, but then there's also I guess I have a different sort of, potentially have a different energy. Maybe I'm a diversity hire, I don't know, but I potentially do bring in more of a female audience because hopefully like I have an energy that other women like. So maybe I kind of bring them in. Like if I can do Counter-Strike, then it gives them hopefully an opportunity to think that they can too. Mm. I mean, I can't play Counter-Strike, but I try. The agency thing, I got all my own work. And so when I started out with my agency, and so it was more them negotiating of things. I represented myself for a while at the end of last year, actually really enjoyed it, but I'm terrible at doing brand deals. I can't represent myself in influencing stuff for shit. And now I'm with CSA and they're great. I joined CSA because my friend Rich, who's also a commentator, I knew him before I started doing this job, and I did my first PUBG job with him. I interviewed him in 2017 when I was still working for Twitch at IM Oakland, where he was doing where I was doing PUBG. That was also Counter-Strike. And when I went in to do PUBG at DreamHack Austin 2018, desk hosting first time with a crowd, him and like Lauren, all the guys of PUBG were so biffin cool. And I've been good mates with Rich ever since. And I know sometimes it could be a bit risky working with your friends, but I trust Rich and he knows the job. So he knows that. He knows what I'm like to work with. He knows what I can do. And so I was like, if I'm going to sign with an agency again, like I will sign with CSA because of him. And they've been fantastic so far. But I would say you don't need an agency to get in. You need contacts. And I had contacts when I worked at Twitch that I never used for hosting. Although ASL UK asked me to host for them, so I feel like that was okay. But I didn't go to them and be like, I'm gonna host for you. I wasn't like in my Twitch inbox like emailing people from it being like, hello, consider me as a host, even though you know me as a producer. But I had a couple of emails, like Shahin, who works for DreamHack. I was emailing him about rights to use a clip in this PUBG documentary I was trying to make. And then when I left, I went, well, might as well just email him and just see. And then got hired for DreamHack. So, yeah.
So a lot of contacts. That's not too surprising. A lot of networking involved for certain. Do you have a demo reel? Do you think a demo reel is necessary?
Yes, I have. I have so many demo reels now. I'm like obsessed with demo reels. I get very enthusiastic about demo reels because I love watching other people's and giving them feedback. Because it's like when I was a producer, I would watch demo reels a lot. And Twitch did these amazing host training sessions. And I don't know if they're still around, but there was some really great feedback in there. Like, don't do a 5-10 minute demo reel. No one wants to watch that if they're in production. They don't have time. If they like what they see in the 2 to 3 minutes that you give them, they will go out and they will find more of your things. They don't need it all in one thing. So one of the things that I do, especially with new talent, maybe if I've done an interview with someone or something, is I'll be like, well, let me see a demo reel if you want. I'll give you some feedback. So I've done that for a few people. And because I think it's really important, because there's no point in emailing someone and being like, by the way, I want to host for you. You have to show them what you're going to bring to the show. And so with a demo reel, it's all about that branding. Like, who are you? My first kind of demo reel featured stuff from me on Twitch and also at Jinx TV as well. The one that springs to mind is my first, I've got one from years ago when I was doing the comedy, like interviewing comedians. So I had a reel from that. And it's somewhere out there, somewhere. I didn't have a fringe. My forehead was on show, for shame. But the one I did in early 2018 had, so it had me on the bridge, Jinx TV, where my role was as the co-host, but most of the time I was co-hosting, but I got to lead host a couple of episodes. My job on that show for me was like, when host Frank chucks me the ball, I take a pin and I just in his face. Like, that was how I kind of operated, right? Because that created an interesting dynamic, because I'm expected to be there as this lady co-host kind of thing representing, and I was like, I'm not here for this shit. So I had some footage from that. I had some footage of me on stage doing interviews with developers about their games. And then I had Hearthstone, this tournament I did in January for ESL, where I'm on stage. So the start of my show reel is me being like, that can be only one reason that I'm standing on stage stroking your bearskin, and that's because it's the show, kind of thing. And that set the tone, which is, okay, she can hold her own on camera, she can be relaxed on camera, and she can make a joke. And that was the whole thing. And then that show reel also has me talking about Overwatch and talking about how you play a certain hero in a kind of a technical way, but the technical term for it was peeing. So it's like a kind of showing that I can like talk about games, I can talk to people about games, but there's always an element of like just a reverence, or like there's always something that's kind of like, right, guys, we're talking about video games for a living. Like, that was my first reel. And as I kind of went on, there was more desk hosting. There was me stage hosting in Sydney, telling like having the Sydney audience like boo at me because I was saying I was British, but I was like pledging allegiance. And then when I was like, but I decided to change allegiance and like go with you guys, and then all of Sydney be like, "Ray!" just modes of moments. My latest show reel, it's not my favorite because I've been indoors for a while, but it's got some cool stuff in it. It's the hardest thing is editing. You've got to edit. Like, you don't want your clips to be over 30 seconds. You want to like, but then I don't need to see a player's answer. Like, if I'm watching someone else with their reel, right? Maybe a little bit of that answer, or maybe if it was something stunning and then they rebounded off it, then great. But I need to see the person. So if they want to do variety games, great. I'm going to see that. If they want to do just one game, I want to see that. I want to see a mixture of things. I don't need to see stage host stuff, analyst stuff, like all that other role stuff. I want to see a mixture of things. Again, multiple games. If you can do multiple games, great, right? Show me all those things, but show me you. That's the most important thing. I need to see who you are. And I hopefully, with my reels, people see who I am, which is normally my latest real life. I yell at someone on a set. So that's me, apparently.
Wow. You are by far the most demo reel interested guest.
I don't know why I'm so obsessed. I think it's because the reason I got to host at DreamHack was because I had a reel ready to go. And I think people talk a lot about not knowing how to break into esports, but they're not doing the thing that gives them the thing. Like how I started working in, like how I got a job as an assistant producer, like doing work experience, like paid at Channel 4, like not much, but like enough to get me through the summer and buy me a sweet fake leather jacket. Like the reason I got to do that was because I had created this blog and I'd gone out there and I found things I was interested in and I wrote about them and I self-published and then I had something to show that I deserve to be given this platform and this opportunity to be paid for it. Like there are people out there who are saying, I really want to cast, but I can't actually do it. Like I need someone to let me cast. It's like, if you can cast, you can cast anything. You can cast your mother making your pancakes in the morning. Like you need to practice and you need to do it. And that could be taking a VOD that you're not technically allowed to broadcast and not broadcasting it, but recording it. Like just do something and then you can show people you can do it, but you can't do the thing. Like you can't do the thing professionally unless you've practiced at doing the thing personally.
Mm-hmm. That's a common theme for sure. Just like just do the thing is a lot of what is suggested here, but it can be, you know, it can seem so intimidating, it can seem so unfair, you know, it doesn't do anything to cry about life being unfair, but there it is. Like it can seem unfair when a really, you know, famous person from one game kind of gets the offer to do another, right? That there is a planning there. The company liked that person, said, can you do this? Like that seems like, oh man, like why am I not at that position where I just get offered these other games? But that's, you know, some people are going to be fortunate enough to have that position and that's great, but you can't ever depend on that. And when you really think about it, if you're doing one particular game and you want to branch into another one, or if you're not there yet in any game, how are they going to find you is a question that you should ask yourself. And how are they going to be able to tell that you can actually do the work? And a demo reel is going to show that. I think times are changing. Literally, I started this podcast last year and everyone I talked to for like 20 episodes said, never had a demo reel, never cared about it in my life. Then I got a couple people saying like, I have a demo reel. And now I've gotten two people, you and I just interviewed Wavepunk yesterday, he said, a demo reel is going to be, you know, really great. And there's certainly not a reason to not have one, as well as always the argument there. So I think it's becoming more of a necessity. I absolutely thank you for going over what you look for in a demo reel. I think that's something that not a lot of people are going to be able to talk on in a professional sense. So that was very helpful. My question for the demo reel then is, do you think that it should be updated? And is there a timeline for the update? Is it every 6 months, every year, whatever? And should there be different types of demo reels that you can keep in your pocket? So if someone says, can you host? You say, here's a hosting reel.
I think that's a good point. I think it can be useful to have separate reels if you're going for a particular role. For me, because desk, stage, sideline, I feel like they all kind of relate to each other, then I think it's fine to have together. If I was looking to kind of commentate, maybe I would have a separate reel. I think demo reels count more probably if you are not established in any game, or you're established in one game and you want to go to another one, right? And you want to kind of demonstrate that you can bring something to this scene. I think in terms of it being updated, the reason I updated mine was because the events got bigger. And so I went from, you know, being in this little studio in London hosting this general show about esports to actually being on a stage in an arena. And so my previous show reel didn't show that I could do that. So that was quite important for me, was like, right, okay, so I'm going to update it as the significance of the events grow. And now sometimes I kind of do it just to show that I've done other things, like more kind of studio based stuff and things like that. Sometimes I'm editing with other platforms in mind. Like I would love to do TV at some point, for example. I need to do more stuff that's based in the UK because how I have to think about my future and how I am still able to do a job or a similar job if I have a family, for example, and things like that. Like my schedule that I had in 2019 was not healthy and was not sustainable. So I have to find that balance. And so I am looking at different mediums and things like that. But I have that problem. I have no idea how I'm going to get in the door at the BBC and things like that. I have calls with them all the time. I advise them on what to do in esports, but they don't necessarily do those things, or they do them, but they do them without me. So yeah, I think reels are really important in terms of like, look, when you're building one, look at where you want to go, but you don't have to keep updating them. You really don't, because if you're established in something, people are going to come for you anyway. I definitely probably am not getting work based on my last show reel. I just kind of made it in a way. I kind of made it for myself. Really, it's kind of nice to, especially when you're in a global pandemic, look back on when you were on stage in Malmo and everyone had the phones out and were like, you know, that gets me every time. Like when you're in an arena and then you're about to start the show and you're just like, hello everyone, can you put your phone lights on please? And then everyone does it and they dim the lights and it is like, oh, it's the most beautiful thing. It's the best. It's the best thing about stage hosting. I find stage hosting the most difficult job of all, but it has its perks.
Why is it so difficult?
So when you are stage hosting, you are on your own. If you're on sideline, you've got a player with you. If you're on an analyst desk, you've got an analyst with you. You were never properly on your own. Sideline can be a bit lonely. You don't have someone to instantly feedback with when you finish, where you should do without with casting and an analyst desk. And when I first started, I'd sort of go up to the green room, like in Katowice with all these people, and be like, oh, that interview is this and that. And it was like, no one cares, dude. Like, stop. Just stop. It's fine. Whatever. With stage hosting, yeah, it's kind of similar to that. But you don't have anyone to kind of riff off. You don't have anyone to pick you up. You are out there on your own. And I think there's also a conflict in esports, which is you got your home broadcast, you've got your crowd. Who are you hosting for? Are you just meant to talk down to the lens and just be like, here we are, so-and-so, and it's now time for our players? Or do you have any time to go out there and actually kind of speak to that audience? Like, what is the broadcast allowing you to do? I fucking love speaking to an audience. Like, again, like Sydney, Showmatch, I was in my absolute element, like chatting to that crowd because they are my people. Sydney is wild. I love that crowd. So I will happily go out there with a mic in the ad breaks and things like that and chat to people and just like, because they made the effort and the time to buy a ticket and spend the weekend with us. They could have stayed at home and watched it there with their mates, all that kind of stuff, in their underwear eating popcorn. And that is a lovely life. I do not dispute those choices at all. I like a popcorn. I like a chocolate. I like a herbal tea and like my sweatpants. I've just kicked my oak table. Anyway, so I'm not disputing that. But if you've come to the arena, like you're owed, I feel like we owe you something extra. So for me, if I'm stage hosting, or even if I'm sidelining, there's no stage host, I'm going to be going out there when I can, just kind of chatting to people and just letting them have something that the people at home don't have. But yeah, so I do think producers kind of need to discuss that more with their stage host sometimes about like what they want. Because I still feel very uncertain sometimes when I'm on stage, more in Counter-Strike actually than anything else. Counter-Strike, I think, because it's like the esport I revere, I've got more nerves about the Counter-Strike audience than anything else. Like I can come out and do a mobile tournament, I can interview a player on stage like after they've won, and I can go on stage and like, to be honest, I can do a really good job. And I don't have the same misgivings about that as Counter-Strike. And I think it's because in Counter-Strike there's people like OJ Borge, who is just, oh, just brilliant. Like his stage hosting is amazing because he's so good with the audience, and he's so good at creating intimate moments with players and asking the right questions. But also he'll talk to us in the green room, and because he's come in from hosting on Radio 2, which is like the biggest network in the UK, he does a night shift for them. He's got two kids, amazing wife. He'll come in. And then he'll just sort of be like, so, okay, so update me on the situation type of thing. I don't know what, he probably does his own research outside of that, but he values what we tell him and he takes it all in and he goes out on stage and he always nails it. And he interviewed Dupree from Team Astralis after they won the major. And I deliberately did not ask to interview Dupree during that whole event because his father had died, had passed away a couple of days before he came to compete in the stage. And also Astralis, most of them got ill as well. It's quite a tough time for them. And I was like, that's not something he should have to think about right now. And then OJ did the interview with him during, you know, after they'd won the final, and it was iconic. And I don't think I could have done the job that OJ did. I think I would be more able to do it now, but I absolutely could not have done it then. So I still don't know if I could do it now. But he's just brilliant at putting people at ease and being curious, and everyone thinks he's amazing because he is. So for me, yeah, I aspire to kind of be that, but I also, that's OJ. I can't be that because I'm not him. Also stage hosting as well, there's technical things. If you're going to stage host, you need in-ears. You have to have molded in-ears. You cannot do arenas successfully if you do not have proper like IFB comms, because you will not be able to hear yourself. You will not be able to hear the player. The players often do not have them, and that's a big issue. So when you look at, for example, Paris, the finals of the World Championships in 2019, and Law goes and does an MVP interview with Caps. I'm pretty sure this was at Paris. He's got an earpiece. And that's great because suddenly you know the player can talk to you. So I hate listening to my voice when I'm on stage because often I sound really shrill and I sound like I am shouting when I'm with a player, but it's because I don't know if they can hear me otherwise because the sound of the microphone echoes around the arena. I also think someone like Smix is amazing at, she doesn't raise her voice like I do. I wish I didn't. She's so good at like gracefully like putting the enormity of what this player has done into the start of her interview. She does it so beautifully, and I am like I'm not as good at doing that kind of thing, so I'm good at being like, hey, here we go, we're gonna watch some video games, and I can do it behind the sideline when I'm just like, okay, so this is a really significant moment in your match because you're about to lose everything. I can do that on stage. I need more of an opportunity, I think, to do it more, and I need to tell myself I can do it, because every time I've done it like for ASL, it's been covering for OJ, and I've told myself I wasn't able to do it, so I need to stop doing that. Start like, you know, and also you can't ask interviews. I'm going on, but like the interviews you do on stage are very different to the ones you do on sideline, not just in tone, but the questions you're asking as well. Don't ask a player a complicated or in-depth gameplay question when they've just won a major, like unless you're asking what was going through your mind during that final round. Like that's fine, that's relevant because you're asking more of an emotional thing, but like but don't sort of just ask about like their map choice, for example, because that's not the hype. And also they're not thinking about the map choice, they're thinking about the fact they just won, man. So yeah, it's just stuff like that.
Yeah, all very good points. You brought up a point that I think a lot of women especially are going to be concerned over, that you know, you don't want to get that shrill voice. Or you think your voice sounds true. As a stage host especially, I feel like that's something that's intimidating for women. There's been women, luckily, in esports that have kind of shown the way and shown that there's perfectly, you know, acceptable, a great job for women, anyone, right? Because you had Smix and Seltzer and Anna kind of lead the charge years and years ago and are still, you know, very popular, very good at their job. But it's one of those things where Golden Boy is an excellent example of someone who has the masculine voice, and not just the masculine voice, but he's got the booming voice, so he can be like the WWE presenter, which he's actually done. And compared to that, it can feel like stage hosting is difficult to do unless you have that perfect control of your voice, because it is, you know, you talked about the technicalities, talk about this, the interviewing, but a lot of time it's about capturing the crowd and getting their interest. And sometimes it seems like the best people who do that are the ones that have that voice. I don't think that's true, but I think that's the stereotype, right? Just like someone will be like, you have a great radio voice because you have a deep voice, you know, and that's not necessarily what makes a great voice. Have you considered this? Is this a problem for you? Do you work on your voice at all? Do you just try to find a way to capture a crowd in a different way if you're unable to do that?
When I started going full time, my voice was really bad. I had real problems and I was terrified. So that was for like probably like for the first few months. And then it got better. And I think one of the reasons voices can go is if you're in an expo hall and you're talking to each other. And then, like, this happened to me when I was producing the Twitch stage at Gamescom, which I did for a couple of years. Your voice would just go because you're talking over PA systems. So it got better. It definitely got better. I don't specifically do stuff with my voice. I probably should if I'm stage hosting. Sometimes I like do the occasional voice exercise and I know them and I should do them more. But yeah, I don't do them much. I think for me, I think the key thing with doing like stage stuff is kind of, again, having practice, but also just like you need someone from production to actually, again, tell you what they want. And if they've got time, make time. Like, I think that's the key thing is like, there are so many brilliant esports talents out there. And most of us are self-taught. And there are moments, I think, which could be better if we had that kind of hands-on guidance. And I think it's partly because of the way that broadcast teams and esports are set up. They're very different to TV, for example. So you don't necessarily have someone who's going to be on hand, who's actually going to want to talk to you about those things and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's really something that can kind of change things for on stage. I think so much of it's just to do with confidence, to be honest, and just being confident in like using that voice. And I have sometimes probably spoken less than I should on stage because I was thinking that my voice wasn't relevant enough. So like when I'm introducing teams, and I know these teams, but I don't know how long I should talk for, but there's no one in my ear saying you can keep talking, or there's no one before the show that says, by the way, you should talk all the way until they get to the stairs or this, that and the other. So it's literally just technical things. It's a conversation. But once you get on site, everyone's so busy. And I do, like, this isn't aimed at any production team in particular. All the production teams I work with are all fantastic in their own ways. I love, that's why I wanted to work in esports in the first place, right? Is the audience. And it was the people that I met when I did that league event. But I think that there are certainly more opportunities for us to kind of do talent development work on site and feedback. Like when you get feedback during an event, you can action that feedback. You can't really action it so successfully between events because you've got to wait for your next event to get it. And what if you don't get rehired? What if you had the performance they wanted in you and no one gave you the feedback to get that performance from you? And I'm so lucky that when I the Katowice Major in 2019, I had people who made that time and they gave me that feedback. And also sometimes I get a message saying that was a great interview or oh, I love that question. And that helped because I didn't really have that from anywhere else because on Reddit, people were tearing me a new one and saying stuff that wasn't true about me. Like, is that amazing? Is it Artosis, that Artosis clip where he's like reading Reddit? Have you seen it?
Oh no, go the on. Of course I've seen it. Yeah. I was surprised you're referencing it.
That cracks me up. That is like one of my favorite things I've ever seen on the internet, which is just Artosis, yeah, reading Reddit and going, this isn't true. This is fucking lies. And I'm like, yes. I have people saying I only ask like yes, no questions, for example. It was like, no, I don't, but you can't do anything. So I just had to leave Reddit. Someone on Twitter, like a well-known esports personality, say that if you're doing interviews in Counter-Strike, you should watch the games and you know, like talk to the analysts and blah blah blah. And it's like, I'm doing all of those things. You're just saying this because I don't know why you're saying this, but you're just saying it because you can, I guess, and you've got an audience. But like, it was like I had no control over those things. It was like I'm doing my job and I'm getting better at my job as I go. Yeah, sure, I'm not perfect yet. But you guys saying stuff that's not true, that's not going to help me be better at my job. And it's also not going to get rid of me because the people that hire me are seeing the job I'm doing. So what is the agenda here? But after a few events, people got used to me and I got better at my job too. And then, you know, I'm part of the furniture now. I'm an old chair that needs repairing. So it's part of that cycle. The circle of esports broadcasting and it gets to us all and you know you rise back up again and you get through it but yeah,
I think there's two every part of this job of esports talent, like on-air talent and broadcasting, has the easy complaint that people just throw out because it's kind of hard to disagree with because there's like things they could bring up, you know, like for casters it's you don't know the game. is the easiest thing that people bring up, and they don't even know. Like, if you ask them to expand on it, they couldn't. They'd be like, well, you just generally don't know. Like, you said that would happen, another thing happened. And you're like, okay, but I also explained that this could happen if this thing, you know, happens, right? So really easy there. And I think, yeah, for hosts and interviewers, it's definitely the, they only ask yes, no questions. I see that so much, and it's so untrue, because, you know, like, yeah, Smix will get the same complaints, and she has made it a point to make sure not to do that. Or like saying, you know, how do you feel all the time is one of those things that people bring up, because sometimes it is relevant to say that, you know, as you were saying at the end of a tournament, you know, just to be like, how did it feel to win that round? Like, oh my God. It's sometimes okay, but it's the easiest thing that people complain about on the internet. Like, it's like, yeah, it's the easiest, I guess, ammo to buy and to send out. So I'm with you there. It's very annoying, but it's never been a place to really go and get feedback, especially if you do get feedback from people you're working with, which I think is an interesting point. You probably are a bit different, actually, than a lot of the people I've talked to, where I think a lot of people in esports still are saying, like, I don't want feedback during the event. I don't want feedback that I don't request, right? And there's reasons to do both. I think what you're saying makes total sense. You know, if you're being a little more subdued because of X, Y reason, but actually they want you to be like super loud and boisterous, then that's a directing thing and you can follow the direction. But we're not quite there yet, I feel like, to have that expectation. So commentators also don't get it, which is unfortunate. And then when we do sometimes we do get that production in our ear telling us to do stuff. That's not communicated to the audience, which I think is one of the biggest downfalls, or not downfalls, but trick to being in this job. So I got told, like, I want you guys to disagree more on the desk. That was something that our producer told us to do. And I did it. And that doesn't get told to the audience. So they just see me as a contrarian, because I kind of upped the little joke between me and a co-caster that I disagree with him. And people were like, always disagreeing. And I was like, damn it, I'm never going to do this again, you know? But the production side of things is the secret side of things, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I wonder how you're supposed to balance that when you do start getting a lot of feedback as well. Like, what if the feedback for an event is something that you actually personally don't feel like you can do, you know? Like, what if they're like, go ask that player who just had something terrible happen to him about that player? Do you ever foresee fights happening along those lines? You ever have a hard stopping point where you're like, going to put your foot down? I'm not going to do that. As we get more into the drama and of esports and try to make it more like, you know, reality show.
I put my foot down. I don't compromise my relationship with the players, because that's going to affect things in the long term. So that's something, again, I learned early on with the interviews, which was like, you can't be the Jeremy Paxman you learned about in the BBC interview training, because you're not a political interviewer. You are interviewing players. It's not my job to hold them to account. It's my job to tell their story. So I will judge things on how I ask, because if I have to do like beef kind of things on stage with two players, it's fine because they're face to face. It's very hard to do. I've maybe done one of those successfully. So the players always have to be briefed in advance on like being asked to do that, and just kind of to sort of encourage them to do it and have fun with it. Because otherwise, if you put them on the spot and say, yeah, insult each other, it's not going to work. And coaches will not do it because they respect each other. Like, I've definitely put in those situations where I've been like, this is not going to work. So I had one coach thing and I had to like save it because I knew it was not going to work. I did try, because I don't want to bomb on camera. I just had to like turn to one of the coaches and be like, well, that response was as spicy as yogurt, because I had to make something from it. So, I sometimes people will be like, we want you to interview this player. And I'll be like, why do you want me to interview that player? And they'll say, because they had the best stats of the match. And I'll say, yeah, but that's not an interesting interview. What is interesting? What am I going to ask them? So how did you have the best performance on the server today? I can ask them that, but it's not going to be an interesting question. Like, I can ask them, it's probably more interesting to be like, you definitely had some troubled performances, but today something changed. How did you get back to being your best? Like, that's, you know, I'll have a think about how I can do it if I need to do it. But like, more or less, I'm going to try and push for the storyline. And there are certain players that aren't going to give me that narrative as well as another player will. So that doesn't mean that I don't want to interview all the players. And I deliberately will, when there's a new player on the team, a young player on the team who hasn't done an interview on camera before, I will try and get them during the group stage. It's really, really important to me. Even more important sometimes than the storyline thing, because I know I'm going to try and make that experience for them as smooth and as kind of easy and pleasant as possible. I'm not saying that any other interviewer would at all. That's I'm talking about myself here, not other interviewers, but I'm conscious of that, because if they have a good experience the first time, this sounds really weird, if they have a good first time, they're going to keep coming back and they're going to be much more open to doing more and more interviews. And as they go, they're going to become more confident. And, you know, like 16-year-old Brolin from Fnatic, 2019 Katowice, they went out first. I never spoke to him, but I started to speak to him at events. And then September, October time, he wins his first event with Fnatic, and I do a stage interview with him. Because over these past few months, and this is not down to me personally, it's down to like him and taking steps and things like that, and his teammates forcing him to do it as well, he became much more confident on camera, and he understood the expectations on him as a professional player. So I've gone off on a tangent, I do this. It's kind of, for me, this is going to make me sound like I'm really difficult to work with. I hate production just being like, right, you're going to interview this player, you're going to ask him this, this, and this question. Because I know the players and I know the storylines and I work really, really hard. So to be reduced to someone who's just told, right, ask these questions. Like, sure, if it's a sponsored job that I'm doing for the money, I don't do like that often, but there's a client there and there's a clear goal, which is to market a product, right? But if I'm telling a story, I should be entrusted to do that. And so that's a collaboration. I will absolutely ask things on the topics they want me to do, but it's my job to decide how I ask that question.
I imagine being that person can be a bit difficult. Not only as someone, as anyone who brings up like, hey, I don't think it's going to work, or this could be better, when you're not part of the pretty, you're just the talent, you know, kind of.
And I'm a woman, I'm not going to lie. And I'm a woman.
Like, I was getting to that point, as well. Like, it's just also that you're a woman, right? So I imagine that's very difficult. Do you credit your years of experience, you know, prior in various jobs? Do you credit some of the hard lessons in life, like what we opened up with, you know, the cruel workplace that kind of toughened you up? Or do you just feel like you are so confident and so well respected in your job that you have the capacity to do these things?
I think with interviewing, because I've been doing it for a couple of years and in different esports and things like that, and because I have those, I kind of like to own those relationships with the players and stuff, I feel like I can do it. And there's been a couple of situations where sort of how the interview's decided has changed, and I've said, okay, let's have a conversation about this workflow, because I can be a bit anxious if something changes, like suddenly I have to ask for permission through other people and I don't understand why. So like when that's happened, I've kind of gone, hey, can we just discuss like why this change, and like, so I can get used to it, I'll get my head around it, and then I will toe the line. But I just need to know why, because it was working as it was working before. So I do sometimes when changes happen, all that kind of stuff, I do ask questions about it. I think like at the radio station, what happened to me was I was producing the show and then the executive producer started having meetings with just my host, and I was removed from conversations about the show I was producing. And I've had that with a couple of like managers in my time, male managers as well. Like I love men. I spend loads of time with men. This is not a man hating thing. But it has happened. I've never had this with women. It's been with men who I think have potentially seen me. I've been quite independent. I have ideas about things. I like to collaborate and all that kind of stuff. But like, you know, I'm confident I can bring something to the table. But I've had myself minimized, or like, but I guess because I have a strong voice, the easiest way to deal with it is to cut me out of the conversation. And that's a weird thing, because I am always open to conversations and collaborating and things. It's a really weird thing for me when that happens, because there's no evidence that I'm not going to listen. So I struggle when someone presents me something and it's a one-way conversation. Because I'm like, hold up, I used to be a senior producer at the BBC and hey, I'm the third best esports host in the world. No, that is a joke. please, everyone know that's a joke. But like, I at least have got enough experience, I think, to kind of back up the fact that like I'm kind of intuitive about certain things in esports. So yeah, it can be tough. And I think also people are kind of, I don't know if they're wary of me or anything, but like I do speak up about things. I'm not as controversial as sometimes people think I am, because obviously I speak about sometimes about being a woman in esports and all that kind of stuff. But I'm not like, I don't go out and slag off TOs and I might speak up about something, but I don't like go out and just be like, oh, this TO this, this TO that. If something goes wrong on a broadcast, I don't throw production under the bus. I don't think I've ever thrown production under the bus. Like I might have said in my ear, oh, I might call to the producer in my ear and make it a thing of the broadcast and just be like, I think I was just asked something in my ear. So I'm just going to just check in with producer Tom and make sure that I'm on the right track here. Or you know, if I missed a cue, I think I might have to throw it to the break, because that's not necessarily production's fault either. That's just like, I just didn't hear them kind of thing. So, but there's certain things like I hopefully, and maybe this is one of the reasons I work, I am professional and I try to be, but I have I do have an anxiety sometimes about saying things, because I could get shut out of the conversation and I could get removed from my job. I didn't lose my job at Twitch because they shut down a load of roles in one day. So like, I have a great relationship with Twitch. I love Twitch. It's all good. I do my job now because of them giving me a job in the first place, and because of them like closing my job because I got to start another one. But because of being a radio as a 21-year-old, and I was 22 when I got put on the doorstep, basically, like my life changed overnight when I suddenly let go and I had to move and sign on the job seekers office and all that kind of stuff. I do get very, if I think I'm not being given the information I need for my job or to have kind of influence on how my job is done.
That's it's pretty terrifying. I think it is much more of a dynamic too between the hosts and interviewers and that production. I think commentators are kind of like we have like a job that usually does not relate to talking and getting feedback ever really. But as a host, yes, I'm constantly in contact with the production, right? So that's more of an anxiety, I think, for you guys out there who are primarily hosts. And it can be tough. I think that every time I've ever talked about feedback in any capacity, though, on the show, it has been more of like, if you're a collaborative effort, if you're trying to make the broadcast better, then it's really hard to say that you're being a bad person, right? If you're coming in with a strong sense of like, no, I think this broadcast would be better if this happens, even if they disagree, it's kind of hard for them to be like, what a jackass, what a bitch, you know? But if you go in and say like, I want to do this because I'm comfortable with it, you turn into an I conversation. Mm-hmm. That's when people feel like they can kind of use that against you, right? But sometimes it is an I conversation. You are a person up on stage who can make a mistake that will live on the internet forever. You have some right to be anxious and some right to be specific with how you communicate and what you want. But it's another delicate line to walk. Especially as a woman, which, you know, we don't unfortunately have a lot of time to get into, but yeah, it's tough, but I think you're doing an excellent job of leading the charge. I really do respect a lot of the things that you do here as a host, as an interviewer, but also all of your social media presence is actually sometimes, I would dare say, inspirational. So thank you, Frankie.
Oh, thank you. Supposed to be tweeting about my garden now.
Yeah, well, we're going to end with a Patreon question. I'd love to talk to you all day, but I know you have one off day and you need to get stuff done. So from the Patreon, we have a kind of a fun question here. You get to pick the city your next major event is in. What city is it?
Amsterdam. Really? Definitely. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Love it. I can train to Amsterdam. So better for the environment, you guys. No, Amsterdam is a city from going there a couple of times. And the first time was to see the RLCS season 2 finals, which Kelly Link hosted. Amazing. Two of the talents who were in the audience leading the cheers, and the British lads there now hosting RLCS, which is super cool. So basically I'm saying I want to host RLCS like on stage in Amsterdam. I just love Amsterdam. I think it's a great city. We did an event, a DreamHack Open in Rotterdam in 2019, and so many things went wrong. They shut the convention center, but they kind of shut all the fans inside who wanted to watch CS with us, which was great. We had a technical issue. I sort of said to production, please give me the microphone, and sort of went out and just started chatting to the crowd. And they were awesome. They were wild. Like, I never get to normally desk host in a situation where I can interact with the crowd, right? I don't do desk hosting in arenas, like maybe one day, but I don't know if I'm going to be given that opportunity. But I made the most of the fact that this crowd behind the scenes could hear me. So I'm like talking to them and like, you know, just getting used to like actually having that response. It was wicked. And Rotterdam's a great city, but I've never got to like host an esports event in Amsterdam. So I would love that. I just think it would be awesome. And loads of people can get to jet from Germany by train very easily. I'm picking up the trains here. I just think it would be great. Yeah. So Amsterdam.
I was kind of thinking you were going to say Sydney.
I love Sydney.
Joined them after all.
Oh, Sydney's amazing, right? Sydney is amazing. And hopefully we'll get to IEM Melbourne at some point. My favorite moment of Sydney, to be honest, was in the ad break. Like, they chant about Henry G, the caster, now GM of Cloud9, being a wanker because he does this thing called the Caches. Team England versus, which is never all English people, England versus Team Australia because of this cricket match we have between the two countries called the Caches. The Ashes, sorry. So the Caches is, because Caches is a map in Counter-Strike, it's like this annual thing. And I sort of was hosting that, and they almost have like a WWE panto setup, but the Counter-Strike is real, and they take it so seriously. It's incredible. But like, so they chant about Henry until the grand final, like, Henry's a wanker. And I just went up during the outbreak and I was just like, guys, calling my friend Henry a wanker. We're watching video games in an arena. It's sunny outside. We're all wankers. And like, and the audience were like, yes. And I was like, these are my people. Sydney and Rotterdam, my two favorite audiences in 2019. Loved Katowice as well. Went to the Berlin Major and was doing reporting. Smix was doing an incredible job interviewing on the sidelines there. Like, I was sort of taking photos of her as she was like on the red carpet interviewing like the finalists before the match and stuff. She was a brilliant person. But like walking around there and just kind of meeting all the fans as well, just having chats with them. I just like to, oh God, I sound like a crazy old woman. I love walking around arenas and talking to people like about the game. Like, I love talking to people just about Counter-Strike and what they think is going to happen. It's literally like in 2015 when I was a nobody and I was watching League of Legends for the first time and I was just talking to people. And now I get to do that, and it's even easier because some of them know who I am. So I can just run up to them and be like, Brett, who do you think is going to win? And it's like, it's the best. I love it. I love my job. I can't wait to get back to LAN. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah. I was so sad. I finally got to do Katowice in 2020. And then, the epic no crowd moment, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think
next year.
Oh, yes. I mean,
it's always StarCraft to Katowice. So we're going to be in dressing rooms next to each other if I also get to keep my job. You will be there.
I hope so.
I'm going to say something stupid and just like not get to do it anymore. So, oh God, I've said it now. It's coming true.
No. I think you're safe as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm hoping that I'll be there. I certainly think it's going to be offline. So I'm mm-hmm. looking forward to that. But I think you're making some people's days when you go out into that crowd. That's what I wanted to say. Remember one of the first times I was still like kind of like a babby commentator, and I was hanging out with Gillyweed actually back when she was in StarCraft years ago. And we sat down at an after party, and Day9 sat down, and he was like clearly tired. And of course everyone knows who Day9 is, but like we were just kind of like, and we kind of like looked at him and we were like, you know, how you doing? And he's like, oh, I'm just so tired. And then he perked up and he goes like, by the way, I'm Sean. And he shakes your hand. He makes sure to do that every time. I feel like I learned so much about being, and it's going to sound cheesy and maybe like inflated, whatever, but I felt like I learned so much about being a celebrity from Day9. The way that he makes everyone just feel like they're his friend when he first meets them makes them so good in these interactions. Whereas before I really thought about this, I was definitely the whole awkward nerd. Like, why do you expect me to bring up conversation points? Why do you expect me to go up to you? And it's like, you're the person that's supposed to do that. And I was like, oh, okay. Otherwise, if you came up to me and was like, you like the game, I'd be like, why are you talking to me? I guess the game's okay.
Exactly. If you're in an arena in the foyer and someone says your name, like, that means you can go up and say hello. kind of thing. Day Nine, yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, he, I mean, my biggest show that I'd ever done at the time in 2018 was PC Gaming Show. And Sean was so great. And I knew Sean as my friend Britt's boyfriend, now husband. So, like, because Britt was someone I worked with at Twitch. We had the same job. She was transitioning into becoming my manager before I left. And they're the most amazing couple. But I've, like, sat backstage with Sean at, like, events that I wasn't necessarily, like, hosting at. And, like, he's just the best storyteller. And he's just a brilliant person to be around. And when I was doing that show for the first time, and that show was, like, reached, like, 2 million people in 2018, I was still, like, really confused as to why I'd been asked to do this job. And I just remember, like, being really frazzled, plane from Texas. And I hadn't slept. I'd been in a youth hostel, hadn't slept. And he handed me, like, an earphone and like just started playing me this really weird music, and we're just like, I was telling this story to someone yesterday when I was trying to explain about Sean, and like we're just like there like this. So each year now it's like, right, Sean, play me the music. What music are we listening to? he's amazing.
Yeah, he really is. It's a lot of amazing personalities in esports. Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
Yeah
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I've taken a little bit more of your time than I was hoping to, but thank you for staying on, answering questions, giving all the deets, talking about some of the difficult conversations as well. Really appreciate it. This would be where you can shout out where you're going to be, where people can find you. I guess, well, CSGO is happening like all the time, but I guess maybe when we'll see you at an event, and maybe in the future.
So currently, Counter-Strike is what I'm up to. I'm doing ESL Pro League. That finishes, I think it's the 11th of April that finishes. You know why? Because on the 8th of April, which is a Thursday, I'm having a front door fitted. So it finishes on the Sunday after that. So I think, quick maths, I think that is the 11th of April. So that's kind of what I'm booked for at the moment. I don't have anything else after that. So, oh God, hire me. It might be nice to have a few weeks off at least to plan a wedding, because I'm getting married, so hopefully in August, and do some other things. But yeah, it's kind of that. And I also host a show for Riot, which goes out on their socials, on Twitter and on YouTube. I think it goes out Wednesdays. We record it on Mondays. It's called the Weekly Rift Review, and it's like 10 minutes of me just chatting about what's happened around the world in League, which is really, it's really fun to do. And on Tuesdays, I'm learning Dota 2 with Purge on my Twitch channel. So sometimes I Twitch, sometimes I post a selfie of myself on Instagram, because that seems to work with the algorithm. But the Instagram story is where I do the house stuff. That's where the more interesting stuff happens. It's on my Insta stories, and then I'm on Twitter at Frankie Ward.
Great. If it makes you feel any better, I feel like there's going to be a transition soon to like more like offline studio stuff. So I feel like some TOs are actually being kind of hesitant in planning for the summer. So maybe that can explain it. She'll get plenty of offers soon. All right. So that cuts it. Thank you so much again. Thank you guys for watching and or listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And I'll see you for the next episode in 2 weeks. Episode 32 coming up in 2 weeks, guys. Pay attention. Follow the Twitter, the Patreon, and all that good stuff. And thanks for watching. We'll see you then. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Caster Calls of Zombie Grub episode 31 with Frankie, and a big thank you to everyone who supports over on the Patreon, patreon.com/zombiegrub, including those who go above and beyond. Thank you, Nick, Adventures of Ark, Vinny, and Steven for helping the podcast to continue. I will be updating a lot of the podcast, both in the audio format as well as the video format, with chapters so that you can read ahead and see what you're interested in and just skip forward. In about the next 2 weeks is probably going to be the process, and that'll be over half of them done as well, and that's a continuing process too. So hopefully that'll increase your enjoyment of the podcast, and it's stuff like that. Like adding chapters, maybe in the future, like total transcriptions, as well as highlight videos and Twitter clips and whatnot. That specifically, you know, makes the podcast better, and also specifically is what the Patreon is there to support. So big thank you to everyone who has at least checked it out. If you can also spread the word, I suppose, about the podcasts and all the different mediums of the forms of community, I suppose, from all the esports, that is also a very big help. But overall, I think this was a really fun podcast. Frankie is someone who I actually think is like just super, super, super good at her job. So I was even a little nervous about asking her to come on, but she was really, really, really friendly. And I think this was a really just pleasant, I know it sounds kind of weird, but it's like a very pleasant, informative podcast with a very excitable person. So hopefully you enjoyed it. Episode 32 of the podcast will be with a Mortal Kombat / kind of fighting game general, I suppose, commentator called Darth Arma. So that'll be coming out in 2 weeks. I'll see you guys then. Bye.